Amarcord. I remember.
Simon Yates is in the pink jersey, the first time he's held a leader's jersey at one of the three Grand Tours. He's been looking very good over the first few days of the Giro, and he really confirmed that today with a fantastic attack. It's been a pretty mind-blowing stage and a pretty mind-blowing day for me. I'm Lionel Burney and Daniel Freeb. Hello.
Hello. Why has it been a mind-blowing day?
It's been fraught with logistical issues and the fact that I haven't eaten for 24 hours.
That's the real nub of the matter. That's the real crux of the matter, isn't it? You haven't eaten. When you say it's been mind-blowing, I mean, it's been fairly mundane by most people's standards on the Giro, apart from the fact that you haven't had your four enormous meals.
Where are we?
Well, we're in the queue to get on the bus, which is going to cross the Strait of Messina. Remember last year?
The bus to cross the Strait of Messina.
I'm looking at a lot of team buses because we're in a big queue surrounded by team vehicles. We're about to get on the boat. Remember last year, we even talked about the bridge that was never built over the Strait of Messina. Still not been built a year later.
You are listening to the Cycling Podcast at Our Giro d'Italia. Brought to you by iWalkUp. Flexible loans built for small businesses. Today, we are in Praia Mare.
Cozze ci tene, cozze vicine. Nu spicudeci cora, nu spicudeci cora. Cozze ci tene.
Where are we, Lionel?
Well, we're in Praia Mare now, Richard, but that, at the start of our episode, was a clip from a couple of years ago when Daniel and I were in the queue to get on the ferry from Sicily across to the mainland. I felt like a regular on that ferry. We spent hours waiting to get on board. I think I commented the second time round ran a lot more smoothly than the first, and I reckon that by about 2025, the Giro's organisers will have got that down to a T, that crossing.
Well, hopefully, Napalm. I don't know if you remember, a couple of years ago, we talked about this, well, what's become a bit of a national joke in Italy about the bridge that's never been built. I don't know where the plans are at the moment as far as connecting the mainland with Sicily with a bridge. I think it's been shelved definitively. But yeah, that's something the Italians are very familiar with, that story.
Well, listen, in the course of the next two episodes, we're building our own bridge, aren't we, between the two sides of Mario Cipollini, in a way. We're looking at the great Italian sprinter, the record holder for stage wins at the Giro d'Italia. You know, a really larger-than-life, flamboyant, charismatic character. An entertainer, really, wasn't he? Mario Cipollini, in his pomp, which was in the 1990s and early 2000s. He was a bit like a dazzling flare that shone brightly and obscured everything else for a while. He was a bit like another charismatic cyclist who emerged or re-emerged in 1999, and I think we'll perhaps draw some parallels between Mario Cipollini and Lance Armstrong over the course of these next two episodes. Because as with Armstrong, there is a dark side to Cipollini, but we're going to really look at his career chronologically. The shades have got darker as the years have gone on, and we're going to start off in this episode looking at the early years of Cipollini up to his pomp, when he was the dominant sprinter in world cycling, but more than that, the biggest personality in world cycling as well, and somebody who I think probably left a very strong impression on the three of us, given the time when we were all getting into following cycling.
So much so, Rich, that I've dressed up as Cipollini today. I don't know if you've noticed.
I forgot to mention that. Yeah, I mean, there's obviously the curls, but also the teeth, Daniel. I'm blinded here in my office. I might have to put my sunglasses on. But you've got the psycho casquette on your head, perched on top of your head.
I thought you were referring to the rippling pecs that you can see, you know.
Fortunately, you've got under my jumper on, so I can't see your torso, which is fortunate, nor yours, Lionel. You're definitely reminiscent, paying a little homage to the psycho years of Mario Cipollini. That psycho, the coffee machine.
Not P-S-Y-C-H-O.
No, because that's certainly something that we'll get onto. But anyway, all you need, Daniel, there are some Brico sunglasses. Remember the Brico sunglasses?
Oh, and the Brico helmets.
His trademark.
Well, we're going to talk about those, aren't we, I think? Or someone is.
We're going to hear from lots of people in these two episodes, including rivals and others who raced with Cipollini. But before we get on to Mario, Super Mario, the Lion King, can you tell us, Lionel, the tale of the Tapa, please?
I can indeed, Rich. It's stage 7 of our Giro from Tropea to Praia a Mare, 211 kilometres or thereabouts. A lovely ride up the coast. Should be very, very flat, but there is a hill in the middle, and naturally, race director Daniele Friberencini has sent our Giro on the RGT cycling platform over that hill. So even on the flattest of flat days, we've got quite a bit of climbing to do. Daniel, anything to say about this?
Well, I can imagine Mario Cipollini's reaction to my race route. I should say, and I think I've already stressed this, I came under great pressure from dark forces behind our Giro to include as many climbs as possible, specifically for the RGT segments. I'm told that on computer cycling, digital cycling, and flat stages are very boring. But it did remind me.
They're fine.
It made me wonder. Stage would have been good.
It made me wonder what Mario Cipollini's reaction to this would have been. Cipollini, I remember there was one Giro presentation in 1997. He attended, as always. He was probably in a zebra print suit or something. When the Giro was unveiled, he was absolutely aghast, and he said it looks like a Giro of Italy's ski resorts. We won't need an accreditation, we'll need a ski pass.
Well, it's already been established.
Not a fan of the mountains.
It's already been established a week in that I'm riding the Intergiro. I'm targeting the Intergiro classification by doing approximately half of the distance. Anyway, Praia a Mare does give the race director of the Giro a few options. Do you remember in 2016, Richard, we were there when Diego Ulissi won a punchy little finish, and we came out of the press room looking for the press buffet for some lunch, and we saw our colleague Alistair Fotheringham, and we asked him, and he waved his arm very kind of vaguely in the direction of nowhere, and we couldn't find what turned out to be the press buffet of the Giro. And we ended up having just a pizza in a little pizzeria. I mean, the pizza was perfectly nice, but
it was actually very nice, yeah.
And then a couple of years after that, Daniel, we were there when Sam Bennett won his first Grand Tour stage. And in the evening, we had an excellent meal, didn't we, with Ciro and the guys from La Gazzetta dello Sport. Was that there? That was.
Yes, in a place called Scalea, just up the coast.
Anyway, let's cross over to the course.
Well, Napalm, before we do, I should just stress as well that the reason I took us to Praia Mare in our Giro was that we had a belting hotel booked, a place called Castello di Seraguimenta, on the way to Castrovillari, which was going to be the start town for the following stage, also the start town in our Giro of the following stage. But you were going to be staying in a tree house in the middle of a vineyard.
Oh.
And I would have paid good money to see that.
Well, let's hope that we get to do that later on in the year or in future years. That's no problem with sleeping in a tree house or Wendy house, whatever you want to lay on, Daniel.
Anyway, kennel.
Kennel, yeah. Anyway, let's cross over to the course and see how the buffalo is getting on the climb.
Day 7 on our Giro. Survived Etna yesterday, just about survived it. But another tough one today. Again, a coastal route largely, but the nasty climb up to Praia Mare at the end. Shout out for Peter McIntosh, who's been letting me sit in his wheel a bit up to the climb. Thank you, Peter. From Australia by the looks of things, so be his evening, my morning. Another tough stage though, and once again a lot of grumbles in the peloton about race director Daniele Friberencini. His coat is on a shugly peg, as we say in Scotland.
You are listening to the Cycling Podcast at Our Giro d'Italia, brought to you by iWaka, flexible loans built for small businesses. iwoca.co.uk.
Big thanks as ever to our title sponsors, iWaka, the award-winning finance company that specialises in lending to small businesses. Founded in 2011, iWaka has issued more than £1 billion to companies ranging from startups to established businesses. iWaka can lend between £1,000 and £250,000, by making it quick and easy to apply for a loan and get a quick decision. It can be a more flexible option than approaching the big banks. For more information on iWaka, go to iwaka.co.uk. Now, today and tomorrow on Our Giro, we're going to be talking about Mario Cipollini, the light and shade of Cipollini. And in today's episode, we're going to be looking at his early years up to his pomp, really, when he was the dominant sprinter in the world. But Lionel, maybe you can take us all the way back to the origins of Mario Cipollini. Where did the Lion King spring from?
Well, yeah, the nicknames, the Lion King and Super Mario, they were to come much later. It's just Super Mario. I mean, he'd have been brilliant at computer game cycling, wouldn't he? Clearly. He'd have been he'd have been leading our Giro on RGT. Anyway, Mario Cipollini.
Not with all that climbing.
It's true. Mario Cipollini was born on March 22nd, 1967 in Lucca. His elder brother, Cesare, was 8 and a bit years older than him and was also a professional cyclist from 1978 to 1990. Mario
born,
was...
Born, did you know this? And I didn't until today, and I haven't found an explanation for it. Cesare was born in Belfort in France.
That's right, yeah. I was going to ask you about that, but I thought...
Well, their dad was a lorry driver. I don't know whether that had anything to do with it.
Well,
probably not, actually, now that I piece it together.
Well, yeah, that's one of the mysteries. Anyway, Mario was a junior world champion in the team time trial on the road in 1985, and he turned professional for the Del Tongo team in 1989, and that was the only season that the only couple of seasons that the two brothers rode together. Also on that team were the reigning world champion Maurizio Fondriest and a future Giro winner Franco Chioccioli. Cipollini's first pro wins came all at once in the Giro di Puglia in April 1989. He won three stages in a row, and a month or so later he got his first Giro d'Italia stage win at the first attempt, or in the first Giro that he took part in, stage 12 in Mira. And in 1990 he followed that up with two stage wins. So he was off to a flyer in terms of winning sprint finishes, Daniel, but was he always destined to be a professional rider? Did his brother's interest in the sport make it inevitable that he would follow in the wheel tracks, so to speak?
Well, I think he would certainly say yes, Napalm. So, as you said, Cesare was a decent pro and won a few things. But, Giro dell'Emilia was probably his biggest win. But Mario used to go and watch Cesare at races. And he tells a famous story about they always used to sort of go up the coast from where they lived near Lucca onto the route of Milan-San Remo and watch San Remo. And Cipollini's birthday often fell, actually, on San Remo. And one year, I don't know how old Cipollini was, maybe 7 or 8, he was there with his dad, Vivaldo, and they watched the peloton go past and Cesare go past. And Mario turned to his dad and said, I promise I will win Milan-San Remo for you one day. So, you know, the seed was already sort of planted at that point. But by all accounts, he's a pretty hyperactive kid. Allegedly, at age 6, he found the keys to his mum's Fiat 500 and took it for a spin around the family sort of plot, the family ranch in San Giusto di Compito. Do you think that's even plausible, that story? As I said, very, very hyperactive. There was the manager of the GIST team, Piero Pieroni, came around to the house one day with a contract for his brother Cesare. And he remembered that Mario was such a handful that the family had tied him to an olive tree with a rope to stop him moving.
That's plausible.
But when he got aboard his, when he got on his bike, he was quite something. He won, I mean, a staggering number of races. The majority of races he took part in as a junior, and even, you know, as he sort of got close to becoming a professional. I think in his last year or two before he did become a professional, legend has it that Cesare would say to other riders in the peloton, well, you better win as much as you can now because my brother's coming and he's going to win everything. And at that point, you know, people weren't only talking about Cipollini as a sprinter. I mean, you mentioned there he had great pedigree as a junior in time trials, in team time trials. He was a world champion, junior world champion. So a bit of a phenomenon by all accounts.
It's interesting, Daniel, looking back at his early wins, because I have a sort of, in my mind's eye, I see Cipollini as this kind of muscle-bound, very imposing character with a quite impressive physique. And of course, a modern or a recent sprinter who's been similar in looks, if nothing else, is Marcel Kittel. But actually, when I was looking up their respective stats, Kittel's a lot bigger than Cipollini. Cipollini wasn't actually that big. He wasn't that heavy. He was tall, but he was actually quite lean. And in those early years, he was quite gangly. The other thing they have in common is having both been very strong time trialists as younger riders before becoming sprinters. And I guess that they were similar, or Cipollini became similar in style as Kittel in you know, being good at going from the front and really taking it on from quite a long way out, being a very strong sprinter and a hard man to get around once he was in front.
Yeah, and when he did start, he was regarded as just a very, very talented young rider, but people had no real inkling that he would become the personality that he did. You know, there was a bit of flourish about him, but he started winning stages in the Giro very early.
Per far sì, c'è una caduta sulla sinistra, mentre con lo sprinter Cipollini che vince.
And yeah, it was only sort of as the years went by, when he moved on from Del Tongo and he joined the MG team and Mercatone Uno, that he really started to embrace well, the sort of legend that he was creating for himself, this larger than life personality.
Ed ecco la maglia di Cipollini in testa, però lo attacca Di Basco, ma è Cipollini che vince con Di Basco in
second. Well, Daniel, you mentioned Cipollini moving on from Del Tongo. He did 3 years at Del Tongo and then joined the GB-MG team, which was a real mashup of Belgian and Italian cycling, wasn't it? The team management was Belgian, but the sort of heartbeat of the team was Italian. And after finishing second to Jamaluddin Abdujaparov at Gent-Wevelgem in 1991, Cipollini backed it up with two victories in back-to-back years, 92 and 93. And this was when Cipollini was really establishing himself as one of the best sprinters in the world. In 92, he won 4 stages in the Giro, including the points jersey, went to the Tour de France for the first time, didn't actually win a stage in 92, but that would soon come. 1993 was probably the first high-profile controversy, I guess, in the finish of Milan-San Remo in the Via Roma. Daniel, perhaps you can tell the story of what happened, because Maurizio Fondres had won the race and Cipollini was part of the peloton that couldn't actually get over the finish line because it was a complete scrum in the finish straight.
Well, you've told it, Napalm, perfectly.
Well,
that's pretty much what happened. Well, Cipollini threw his bike through the rear windscreen of race director Carmine Castellano in a fit of pique. An authentic Italian casino and a big mess that you often get at the end of Milan-San Remo.
93 as well, Cipollini won his first Tour de France stage and held a yellow jersey for 3 days. And in 94, you know, the sort of controversial moments that stick in the mind, you know, they came fairly thick and fast. But in 94, he won the opening stage of Paris-Nice, and the following day, whilst wearing the leader's white jersey, was photographed smoking a cigarette as he was riding through the convoy of team cars. Other incidents around that time, he got fined for using a mobile phone in the bunch. Not the only rider to have done that, but, you know, when Cipollini does...
He boasted that he was the first. He actually boasted about that quite recently. That he was the first rider to make a mobile phone call mid-race.
But that year, he was second in Milan-San Remo, the race that he prized probably above all others, certainly the one-day races. He won the bunch sprint behind Giorgio Furlan. And the year was really curtailed for him by a terrible crash at the Vuelta, which was held in the spring in those days. One of the early stages finished in Salamanca, and his teammate, another very good Italian sprinter, Adriano Baffi, basically took him all the way across the road and stuck Cipollini in the barriers. And it was a crash that really took its toll and wiped out most of the rest of the season for him in 94.
The Cycling Podcast at Our Giro d'Italia is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you very much indeed to our longtime sponsors, Science in Sport. And don't forget, you can still get 25% off all your Science in Sport products at scienceandsport.com with the code SISCP25. They've been busy launching quite a few new products over the last few weeks and months, Science and Sport. So go and have a look at what they've got to offer. If you are spending most of your time indoor cycling at the moment, lots of good hydration products there as well. So go to scienceandsport.com and use your code SISCP25 to get 25% off.
Vino del giorno. Cin cin.
Our next wine in the cycling podcast full Giro case is the Caravaggio Occhio di Terra, which is a Malvasia di Lipari grape. Now, this unique grape has been harvested from organic vineyards on the island of Salina, just off the coast of Sicily. Now, the grapes, once crushed, are left in contact with the skin for up to 30 days in stainless steel. It's then fermented on the lees to give it a slightly sort of fuller texture, but the net result is a briny, salty wine that has some real lifted floral aromas that almost lull you into thinking it's sweet, but it's not, it's bone dry. The wine itself does have a little bit of texture, but by no means is it fat or too weighty. In fact, it's the type of wine that just has you crying out for a plate of clams or a spaghetti con vongole. I hope you enjoy.
Well, I don't know about you chaps, but I thought Greg was bang on there with this. It does lull you into thinking it's sweet, maybe a bit like Mario Cipollini in the mid-90s. You could
nice link.
You could be drinking it. I mean, it reminds me a bit of a Vinsanto, the famous Tuscan sweet wine, which I don't particularly like. Same grape, Malvasia. But then, as Greg says, the sort of sweetness fades away.
It smells sweet, doesn't it? Yep. There's a bit of honey there, Daniel. Gooseberry, maybe.
You're really coming into form now. Gooseberry, I'm not so sure about, but we'll get there.
Grapefruit. Grapefruit.
Just very quickly, chaps. This wine is from the Aeolian Islands, which are the islands between Sicily and Reggio Calabria or Praia Mare, where we were going today. And we've never been there. Giro's never been there. I don't know if the Giro could go there. I don't know if there are enough roads to host the Giro on Salina, where this wine's from. But it's a favourite spot of our good friend Ciro Scognamiglio.
Of course it is. Well, listen, from a white wine, and do remember to drink responsibly, from a white wine to a man named White. Although, as Mario Cipollini called him, Black. That was his little joke. Matt White, the now sports director at Mitchelton Scott, but a rider from Australia who went over to Italy to turn professional in the 90s and lived in Lucca, where Cipollini has lived for a long time. And so I got to know him quite well when he was setting out on his career. Let's hear from Matt White on Mario Cipollini now.
When I first turned professional in 98, I was living in Tuscany, in Lucca, just outside of Lucca. So Cipollini lives there. So I would see him out quite regularly on the bike. And there'd be training groups that I'd tag along to as well. And I'd never raced a day in Italy, never been to Italy. And all of a sudden I'm living there racing on Italian teams. And I remember the 98 Giro, my first Giro, and I didn't understand how Italian racing sort of worked. And I heard stuff that he used to run the show in the Gruppetto and that sort of stuff. And I remember the first mountain stage, I'd been dropped and I was battling away halfway up this 10-kilometer climb, and Cipollini came past me holding on to the light of the police motorbike. Weaving away there and groveling away, and Mario is just holding on to the back of the light on the police motorbike. Just went screaming past us, and we saw him at the top of the climb waiting for us. That's the first time I ever saw him in the Giro. The second time was on the start of a mountain stage, and I'd been told that we wanted to from the team that we needed to get people in breakaways. So I'd lined up in the neutral area up near the front. Anyway, Mario Cipollini had taken the front row of the race. Just before he came up to neutral, he put his hands up in the air and he said, and I could hear him in Italian saying, "Two climbs, no racing, then we start, okay?" And so everyone could hear, he's yelling it out, he's at the front of the race. And I was like to the team, what does he mean? And he said, "Oh, no, we're not, the first two climbs we're going steady." And I said, "What? Why is that?" He said, "Oh, Mario's called it." And anyway, some little Colombian or some little South Americans ripped out of the bunch at kilometre zero. Mario chased him down, and actually helmet popped him. And this little I can't remember who it was. This little climber was, but didn't know what it hit him. You know, Mario just sprinted after him, caught him, and boom, on the top of the head. Because those days there was no live television at the start. And I remember that they used to have a Chiclamino jersey, which used to be an intermediate sprint halfway through the stage, and that was a separate jersey just for that sprint. And they used to say that, you know, when the helicopter would come over, maybe 5 to 10 minutes before that intermediate sprint. And a lot of the stages you weren't allowed to race until you heard that helicopter. They might let some token Italian teams go up the road for the television for the break or whatever on some of the flat stages. But now he ruled Italian racing with an iron fist. That was incredible. And then another one with Mario. I remember the year that he won 4 stages in the Tour de France, and then he pulled out day 6 or 7. Anyway, I was going for a ride, and I'd moved places, and I was living in La Spezia. And my recovery rides, I wasn't riding the Tour, I rode the Giro that year. So it was like the middle of July, 10 days into the Tour de France. And so I used to go for a ride in the mornings, then come home and watch the Tour de France in the afternoons. So I was down near Via Reggio, and I was riding south, and I saw this guy riding up the other direction. And this guy had no shirt on, and as dark as anything. And I got closer, and it was Mario. He had no shirt on, rolled the nicks up really high, and his hair was slicked with all the gel in it, and he had the glasses on, and he looked across the road, waved at me. He used to call me black because he used to think it was quite funny, the opposite of white. And he looked across the road, and he said, "Ciao, black." And this was like, he'd been to the Tour de France 3 days before. I wouldn't say I was friends with him, but, you know, because I trained with him when I was 98, and then, you know, I did a lot of Giros in those early years. So we knew each other, and then even after he retired, you'd see him at the Giro every year with a white flannelette shirt there, buttoned down to about 4 buttons, with a big chain on there, tanned as. So I always say good day to him. And they certainly broke the mold with Mario, that's for sure. He had a lot of charisma, and all the teams in his later years were just built around him, and my God, did he deliver.
Well, another man who saw Mario Cipollini up close for many years was Graham Watson, the photographer who covered all of Cipollini's career at the Giro d'Italia, and has a story or two to tell. And let's hear one from Graham, which kind of amplifies really what Matt White was saying about how Mario Cipollini set his own rules.
Most of the stories in the Tour Ridley are about Mario Cipollini. He dominated the race for so long. Once he had a friend of mine go ahead, and in Italy, you don't just buy a mozzarella sandwich. You get it prepared at the first of all, you go to the bakery shop and buy a roll of bread. Then you go to the delicatessen, and they all provide you with the tomatoes and also the mozzarella cheese and anything else you want. And it's made for you while you wait. You don't go ahead and buy it like you do today in a cellophane wrapper. So Cipollini had one Italian patrol went ahead and ordered the bread roll. And when I say go ahead, I mean he had to go ahead probably for 35, 40 minutes ahead of the race. And the same guy ordered the tomato mozzarella from the delicatessen, but someone else had to come in the shop and pick it up because the race was just going by. But that's largely what Cipollini did. But definitely he ordered a nice tomato mozzarella sandwich off a photographer, not me. And he was given it. I actually heard he stopped for a plate of pasta once. He pre-ordered it, or he had someone pre-order it for him. And there's even these exaggerations whereby he controlled the speed of the peloton just so that when they got to this village where his bowl of pasta was waiting, it was just at the perfect time. Every story you hear, it gets more and more exaggerated, but there are elements of truth in it.
Not sure about you two, but talk of having a sandwich is making me hungry.
You're always hungry. You don't need an excuse or some kind of cue.
This is true.
Il ristorante. Oh no. Okay. No.
Sorry, if you're not hungry, then you're anticipating hunger.
Well, that is true, Richard. And one of the joys of travelling around the Giro is eating my way around Italy. And I've discovered some dishes that I really would have dismissed just from a written description. And today's recipe of the day is one of those, pasta sammudica, which on paper doesn't sound terribly promising. Pasta with dried breadcrumbs fried in olive oil. It sounds like it's going to be pretty bland. Let's hear from food writer Felicity Cloak, who's also the author of the very fine book One More Croissant for the Road, about pasta samudica.
Il ristorante.
Is this a reasonably new one on you, pasta samudica? Because I have eaten it as a prima piatti in it was actually in Calabria where I'd had it before, and I was really taken with it, but didn't know a great deal about it. And it's not something, when I was even googling recipes, really wasn't coming up with much in the UK. It was mostly kind of American websites, and they did all sorts of weird things with them. So I actually had to look up an Italian recipe and get as close as I could.
Well, I have to say, I did know this dish before you mentioned it, but I didn't know what it was called. So it's a very sort of classic cucina povera dish born of necessity, basically. Very popular down in Sicily and Calabria, which have been historically quite poor regions. And so it's the kind of dish that uses the things that you might have in the store cupboard at the end of the week when everything else, all the fresh stuff's run out. And it uses, mudica actually means breadcrumbs, and so it's sort of seasoned breadcrumbs. So you fry any old bit of stale bread, or you can use fresh bread if you happen to be fancy and have fresh bread to spare. And you fry those up in olive oil and a bit of seasoning, and then you can use that for all sorts of things. If you're feeling a bit flush, you can use them to stuff fish like sardines or any of the other wonderful seafood they get down there, or peppers, they soak up all the nice juices. Or you can simply do, as with this pasta dish, toss them with pasta. And actually, you don't really need anything more if you season them well and there's enough olive oil in there, which is something that, you know, is quite abundant down there, then you don't really need anything else. But quite often these days you get stuff, you get garlic, you can get anchovies are quite popular. I like it with anchovies because I always have them hanging around. You can add chili. I've even seen it quite a Sicilian touch with some pine nuts and raisins, which is very typically Sicilian sort of Moorish combination. But it's a really adaptable dish and a really easy one, and I think it comes together in, I don't know how long the pasta takes to cook, maybe you just have it on the table certainly within 15 minutes, and it's weirdly delicious, I find it, because you think, oh, what, you know, pasta and breadcrumbs, carb on carb. But I love it, and I think actually it'd be the perfect thing if you've been doing a bit of climbing in the hot South Italian sun. I can imagine tucking into two portions of this.
Well, I did use anchovies. I possibly was a little heavy on the anchovies because I think, as I said, my partner doesn't eat anything from the sea. So I made two batches of this and put all of the anchovies in my half, which possibly upset the balance slightly. But I did manage to balance it back out again with the pecorino and with a little bit of fresh chili, which just gave it a sort of a heat and freshness. But in terms of being able to assess it, I mean, did it look at all appetizing? You mentioned carb on carbs. I mean, it's a hard one to make look beautiful, I felt.
I mean, I suppose it does depend on you seeing the beauty in the carb, and I love a sort of triple carb plate. I'm all about the beige food, so I didn't find that a problem. And actually, you'd made a real effort with the setting of the photo you'd sent me. Maybe you were a bit worried about that, because it looked beautiful. A couple of things stood out for me. I think I agree that maybe you went a bit heavy with the anchovies, and I think maybe you should have let them dissolve into the oil before you tossed it with the pasta, because they look like they're in quite big chunks. I think you used fresh chili, did you? Which looked pretty, but probably, I think I'd probably use dry chili if I was going for it, because fresh chili probably isn't very authentic. But if it tasted good, I'm about to say I'm not judging. Obviously, I'm judging you. But yeah.
Oh, I feel hungry, Lionel. Nice to get another flavour of your restaurant out there in Watford, cooking up all these marvellous Italian dishes. Shame I can't visit at the moment. Shame the doors are closed. Did you do home delivery at all?
No. Sorry. It'll be cold by the time it gets to you in Tooting.
That's true. On with Mario Cipollini.
Indeed. Well, from 95 to 99, he's really approaching the peak of his powers and racking up Giro and Tour stage wins. In 96, he won four Giro stages again. He was Italian national champion for the first and only time. And that was his first year with the Seiko team. In 97, he wins five Giro stages and overtakes Gino Bartali in the league table of Giro stage winners. And this is when Mario Cipollini has a marketing tool is born, really. He's riding the Cannondale bike. He wears yellow shorts to go with the yellow jersey in the Tour de France, which at the time was an offence that was punishable by a series of small fines, but he kept doing it. Prior to that, he'd worn the Stars and Stripes shorts, of course, to publicise the Cannondale bike. And he's really becoming a marketing phenomenon, and things that you probably frown upon a bit now, such as having an image of Pamela Anderson painted on his bike. I mean, you know, sort of its era, I guess. But he keeps racking up these Giro stage wins, and by 1999 he's really leaving his mark on the Tour de France as well, winning four stages in a row, including at the time the fastest ever road stage that year. The one thing that displeased the Tour de France organisers, though, was that he would always pull out before the mountains, never actually finished the Tour in his career. But by the end of the 90s, Mario Cipollini is a phenomenon, really.
By the main field here, but a very small group indeed, about 50 riders competing for the sprint. Chris Boardman has made the split, but the time bonuses could well lose him the race lead. As the finish approaches, Mario Cipollini leads all the way to the line. For it, Cipollini is towing the best sprinters towards the line, but you'll never get by this man when he has such a clear shot at the finish line. And he's being challenged right by Zabel again. Zabel beaten, and right on the line, Mario Cipollini is back for it now. Cipollini, and coming is Tom Steels. Steels comes past Zabel, but on the line, Cipollini makes it two in a row. And Steels is coming over on Cipollini, shoulder to shoulder. Steels on the line, but I'm not so sure the judges will like that, Paul. It looked a little bit shaky. Tom Steels has been called onto the podium by the race organisation, but almost at the same time as he takes the applause of the crowd here, the referees are saying he has been disqualified from first place and placed to the back of the field for his dangerous sprinting. So in fact, Cipollini is the stage winner. Fagnini now once more launching the missile at the finish, as again he waits until the last possible moment. Cipollini, remember, he's aiming now at a 69 year old record. Cipollini's gone, and what's happened to Zabel? Lost both his pedals at the same time, and how he's kept that bike upright I don't know, but he's given a clear run now to Cipollini. He's done it, four in a row for Mario Cipollini.
Yeah, he was a phenomenon, certainly off the bike, or he's becoming one, wasn't he, Napalm? Particularly when he moved to Seiko and they linked up with Cannondale. There were some very smart people in the marketing department at Cannondale who really started to sort of leverage Cipollini's image. But he'd really particularly started to embrace this image of himself as a sex symbol, coinciding, coincidentally or not, with him getting married. In 1993, he got married to the daughter of a famous former goalkeeper, Fiorentina football goalkeeper. And around that time, he started very frequently referencing sex in interviews. There was an interview at the Vuelta in 1993 where he said an orgasm only lasts a few seconds, a victory lasts forever. And that was often cited in future years. He also said once, I'm a hermaphrodite, I've got a on the brain and a between my legs. I think you can fill in the gaps. And any opportunity really to talk about sex, he grabbed it with both hands. There was another occasion at the Giro d'Italia in 97 when he complained that everyone in the room, the journalists, looked miserable, and there was only a day till the end of the Giro, and he said to them, you know, you all should cheer up. When we get home after the Giro, the second thing we do is put down our suitcases, inferring that the first thing the riders did was something else.
Did we need that, Daniel, that explanation? I'm not sure.
I don't know. I think I got the gist.
But I vividly remember the opening to the Tour de France coverage one year when it was all about Cipollini against Jamaluddin Abdujaparov, and there was a camera panning the length of Cipollini's kind of sculpted body. And it did seem to me at the time that part of that, from Cipollini's point of view, was the contrast with the Tashkent Terror with Abdujaprov, who was this kind of doer, monosyllabic Eastern European sprinter. And Cipollini, in setting himself apart from Abdujaprov, seemed to go to the other extreme. I don't know if that was part of that kind of act at the time or whether that was just Cipollini finding his true self and expressing, you know, who he thought he was.
I mean, I think a big part of it was Cipollini playing to a receptive audience. And, you know, we all know that the Italians love an alpha. It's a very sort of visual culture, really unashamedly objectifies women. I mean, again, it may be a coincidence, but in 1994, Silvio Berlusconi became the prime minister for the first time, the first of his three terms in Italy. And he was someone who was really celebrated and glorified in Italy for the way he objectified women, really, you know, went through several marriages, always boasted about affairs, to be honest. And, you know, Italy and even the Italian language objectifies women to an extent that other languages don't. You know, if I was referring to your wife, Rich, in Italian, I would call her the more, whereas you would just be more. And, you know, this is something that women do as well. They call each other, you know, they use the definite article. They literally objectify each other. And, you know, everything is sexualized in Italy. I was talking to Napalm the other day about cookbooks in Italy. This is something that John Dickey, who we had on the pod a couple of days ago, talks about in one of his books, Delizia, how cookbooks in Italy, particularly in the 70s and 80s, they were very sort of erotic almost. Sophia Loren did a very famous cookbook in Italy where she was sort of, you know, she had her shirt unbuttoned and it was called In the Kitchen with Love, and it became this sensation. It sold, you know, I don't know whether it was millions of copies, and then, you know, there were famous quotes from her: everything you see I owe to spaghetti. And you know, everything in Italy is sort of sexualized to a certain extent. And so when Cipollini said that kind of thing about, you know, orgasms and comparing orgasms and victories, people really lapped it up, especially in a sport, in a sort of blue-collar sport like professional cycling, with no real airs and graces at that time.
Just makes me think back to last year and that extraordinary night where we had dinner with our B&B host, and the TV, Saturday night TV in Italy, really, I mean, it was extraordinary. It was women in bikinis, you know, clambering up wet slides, women in bikinis wrestling in mud, women in bikinis. I mean, it was just, there was just no nuance to it whatsoever. And this was kind of prime time on the most popular channel in Italy. And didn't he say to you, Daniel, this is the best program in Italy? I mean, yeah, there we are. It was an uncomfortable dinner, that, wasn't it, for a number of reasons.
It was it's immortalised in our book, isn't it, that dinner with the Italian Bruce Willis and his gun collection. But anyway, it's a whole other story. But yeah, I mean, so you're saying basically Cipollini was part of that culture, but also playing to that culture as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And as I said, the marketing men, or there was certainly, well, the marketing department at Cannondale were very successful in creating the sex symbol out of him. He loved it. And, you know, the question was never really, no one ever really sort of raised their hand and said, well, hang on, this guy's married, isn't he? You know, he's supposed to be a family man.
Well, more to the point, Northwave, the shoe company, there was a very famous advert with Cipollini holding a naked woman in his arms. I mean, he's wearing his cycling shoes and a what looks to me to be like some kind of flamboyant sort of Renaissance soldier's outfit. I mean, you can Google it if you really want to see it. But I mean, it really was of its time. And those adverts were commonplace, weren't they? They were printed in magazines. And you know, it's only, 20 years ago. But, you know, values have changed quite significantly since those days.
There was another occasion, chaps, quite where he missed the start of a Giro stage, and it was reported in all of the papers the next day because he was chatting to Miss World.
I mean, obviously, his antics got a lot of attention, which was the whole point. And it wasn't always sort of on a sexual theme. You know, he dressed up in all kinds of flamboyant outfits, often at the Tour de France, you know, the biggest stage of all. And he had a very complicated relationship with the Tour de France. You got the sense that there was a sort of unrequited love there. The Tour didn't really embrace Cipollini's flamboyance in the way that Cipollini embraced the sort of stage that the Tour offered. And in his later years, which we'll hear about, his team often wasn't invited to the Tour. They didn't even want him.
He did treat it with a bit of disrespect, didn't he? I mean, there was a story, there was a story in 95 that he cranked up the air conditioning in his hotel room deliberately so he could get ill, and that would give him a legitimate excuse to leave the Tour. What actually happened was his roommate Silvio Martinello got ill instead.
And we heard from Matt White earlier about, you know, him spotting him training days after having pulled out the Tour. Clearly nothing physically wrong with him. But what all this obscures or overlooks is that he must have been a serious athlete, you know, to compete at the level that he competed at for so many years. It was an aspect that he probably deliberately underplayed, because it didn't fit with the image. But to have that success, to be that good, and in a, you know, domain sprinting that really is not for the faint-hearted, you need to be brave and courageous and take risks. Cipollini was there, and you know, an impressive athlete too. And we're going to hear now from the Belgian sprinter Tom Steels, who went sort of head to head with him. And Steels is a kind of complete contrast in every way. He's still a sports director with De Koen at Quickstep. And it's interesting, he won stage one of the Tour de France in 1998 in Dublin. And I was there, and I when I heard him mention that win, I was shocked, because in my memory, Cipollini won the stage simply because at the end of the stage, everybody surrounded Cipollini, including me and my brother. You know, it was Cipollini that stole all the attention, but it was Tom Steels who actually won that stage, which says a lot. And yeah, Steels was somebody who went head to head with him a lot and really saw up close Cipollini, the athlete.
Yeah, it was always special. I think Mario Cipollini that year was for sure one of the fastest. He had a very strong team who was tactically always on the right path, so they could really time the sprinting well. So you really had to be 100% to beat him. And also tactically, you really had to choose his wheel, because one position behind him and it was already difficult to win the race. So he was like the man to beat in our years, because he was, I think, one of the fastest. But he also had that little bit of extra, that charisma, that part of the show he always made before the starts. And, yeah, he was a figure. He was one of the leaders also of the peloton. So he was the man to beat. Let us say they had a one-man team. They all rode for Cipollini, and they just had to ride riders for it. Once, for instance, Mario Scirea went from kilometer 2 to 1, they really, really lined it up. He always had good lead-out men. But he was also himself also quite intelligent, even if his lead-out range wasn't perfect. He always found a solution. So yeah, you could learn a lot from him also. But for sure, Psycho at that period had really a good lead out train. But of course, the thing is with the sprinter, to really be a top sprinter, if you do 10 sprints, you almost have to gain 5 or 6, especially when a whole team is built around you. And Cipollini for sure made that average quite easy. On 10 sprints, he didn't lose so much, and that's why he was for sure the leader of the team, and he could also build the team around him. Also, of course, if you're on the bike and you want to win the bike races, especially for sprinters, then you just have that little bit of more adrenaline. So once on the bike, then of course you had a lot of respect for him. For sure, it was a guy that you didn't went into a fight with Cipollini. I mean, you could fight with other sprinters, but not with Cipollini. So you always had to find a way to kind of leave him alone, but still make that fight to be in his wheel. So the biggest fight was always behind him. But he also never really picked a fight. Also, that was not also his style. So I cannot remember one one fight with Cipollini for position. He just rode around. He was also a very good bike rider. So the fight was always behind him. I think in my career we didn't do so many races together, but man to man, I could beat him three or four times, I think, in real pure speed. It was not easy. It could maintain his power quite a long time, but he could also come from behind. But his specialty was really to start in the lead and just to maintain the speed, and it was difficult to beat there. The thing is with him, he was even if he lost even for a week, he stayed always the same. So he was never really super nervous on that point, because if a sprinter starts to lose, he couldn't win the first week, he tends to get really, really nervous. But with him, he always stayed calm. He tried again. But on the bike, during the race, you didn't see anything about him. He was still laughing. He was still making jokes. But once he got the first victory in, then you really had to be sharp to beat him again. Yeah, it seems to be that he needed some days to get on real speed. But I must say also physically, I never saw Cipollini also bad. He was also quite good in shape. Yeah, you have different kind of sprinters, of course. I think I was maybe more typical a sprinter with the heavy legs and the explosivity. He was tall. He had also not really. He had a lot of muscles, but not really typical. If you saw him on a picture, you couldn't say if he was a sprinter or a good all round rider. If you saw me on a picture, then yeah, of course, with the legs, you see almost immediately that I was a sprinter. So he had a little bit of atypical build-up, but there are also other sprinters who have the same characteristics. Huh? But of course, if you would have been in a boxing ring, first thing I would do is jump out, that's for sure. I ride, especially in the Tour, you're always in stress, and anything you have to do above is too much. But he was dressed up like a Roman. The whole team was dressed up like a Roman, and that way he went to the podium. So all the hassle around it. So you have clothing, you have to change clothing before the start. But for him, I think he needed it to do that little bit of extra, which was good for the sport. Also the bikes, they looked great, huh? That's was perfect marketing. But also not only marketing, but I think he needed it just to be the showman, just to be the biggest actor of all. So, I think it's very close to his personality. It's also one of the few riders that when stopped riding, didn't gain weight. He still looks like he stopped yesterday. So I think his ego, his personality is quite high. But I think for the sport was great. I mean, he was the man to beat, first of all, because he was physically strong, but also because you knew if you beat him, he just couldn't stand to lose also. So it was a bit of a battle between all the sprinters and him. But I must say, he was he was always a fair sprinter. I cannot imagine he got in trouble by a lot.
Well, you mentioned Mario Cipollini treating the Tour de France as a marketing vehicle. I think you said treating it with a slight lack of respect in some ways. None more evident really than in 1999, when he dressed up as Julius Caesar on July the 12th to mark Caesar's birthday.
Which was brilliant, wasn't it?
I mean, it was brilliant. I was there that day, and it absolutely drew everyone towards Cipollini. It made Cipollini almost bigger than the Tour de France for an hour or so. And in true Cipollini style, the riders and the Seiko team all wore a different jersey. It was a kind of gold and white type jersey rather than the traditional red that they usually wore. So they attracted a load of fines for that. And then Cipollini pulled out of the race and went home before they got to the first big climb of the day. I mean, it was Cipollini in a nutshell, really.
bit like Lionel Burney in the Giro.
The Inter Giro, yeah, the Inter Tour.
We found that parallel now.
Yeah,
you know.
That's literally the only comparison between me and Cipollini, I can assure you. But yeah, Cipollini in the year 2000 perhaps paid the price for those antics, because the Tour de France left his team out of the race. pace. I mean, extraordinary now when you think the Tour would leave out a rider of his kind of stature and magnetism. But you can only assume it was because he never made it over the mountains, never really took the green jersey contest seriously. I mean, could have finished the Tour and won, racked up more stages, but didn't. By this stage, 2000, Cipollini won his 30th Giro stage, which at the time drew him level with Costante Girardengo in the all-time list in third place. Later on in the year at the Vuelta, he was kicked out of the race for punching Francisco Cerezo before the stage start, actually at the sign-on or near the sign-on podium. They'd had a bit of beef the previous day. Cipollini was upset that Cerezo had kind of edged him into the crowd. He tried to gain his retribution on the road that day. He didn't manage to, but it was still simmering the next morning. So got him with a right hook, and Cerezo needed stitches. I mean, you know, unacceptable behaviour in any era from any figure in the sport, laying a hand on another rider, especially after, you know, not in the heat of the moment. You know, amazing.
Yeah, I mean, this was something that also came to the fore and became quite well known about Cipollini, how imposing he was physically and how he brought that force. He could, well, threaten to bring that force to bear or actually do it. You know, we heard from Matt White earlier about the way he would sort of police the peloton. There was a similar story from Miguel Martinez, the mountain biker who then went on to ride for Mapei, about him doing something similar, sort of riding after him and putting a big paw on Martinez's helmet and sort of rotating it like a joystick and telling him he would never ride another race if he did that again, if he tried to attack, you know, when Cipollini had decreed that he wasn't allowed to. But there's no doubt that for young sprinters at that time, he was the sort of monument, the totem, everything that they wanted to be in a lot of respects. You know, we heard the other day from Ivan Quaranta when he beat Cipollini in the first stage of the Giro. And what we didn't really hear from Quaranta was the sort of mixed feelings he had about beating Cipollini that day. And then Ivan also told me a very funny story about another victory over Cipollini in the 2000 Giro.
Praticamente la sensazione che io ho avuto la prima volta che l'ho battuto.
The feeling I had when I first beat him there was one of sorrow, regret almost. Deep down, I was almost upset that I'd beaten him. Later, it happened relatively often, and he became a colleague, a regular opponent. But when I came out of that last bend that day and went past him, I looked at him, and my heart sort of sank. Bear in mind that when I was 15, 16, I'd had his poster on my wall. He was already Cipollini. Then when I became a junior, he'd started winning all these stages in the Giro, and he was an idol. If you were a sprinter, it was all about Cipollini. And I used to get really pissed off whenever he lost. It was like your favourite football team losing. So when I beat him in 1999, it was like a myth had crumbled. That's also what I said to him the next day. His answer to that was, "Listen, youngster," that's what he used to call me. "Youngster," he said, "even the most beautiful things have a beginning and an end. But remember that Cipollini is not finished yet, and he's going to be a thorn in your side for the rest of your career." He was joking, but he was also right. He was one of those tenacious old Tuscan wolves, and in fact, he won a lot more after that. The Worlds, San Remo, Gent Wevelgem, and so on and so on. Anyway, I'll never forget that feeling I had when I beat him. It was like scoring a penalty past the goalkeeper of the team you support.
Perché per me è come segnare un rigore al tuo portiere della tua squadra del cuore, no? Una volta che a Padova, l'arrivo di Padova, che io ero da solo, ho perso tutti i compagni di squadra perché c'era un ventaglio.
In the 2000 Giro, there was a stage to Padova, and I'd lost all of my teammates in an echelon or something not far from the finish. There were 60, 70 riders left, and I was on my own, with no lead-out train. The last 20 kilometers were almost entirely straight, but the road was going to curve a little over a narrow bridge or a chicane 500 meters from the finish. I knew this because I'd done my homework. I'd really studied that finish. I'd said to myself that if you weren't one of the first five over that little bridge, you'd lost. The first five guys would hold their speed, and if Cipollini and his lead-out man were in that five and you weren't, you'd lose all of your momentum while they'd be going at 60 kilometers an hour. You'd need a motorbike to catch them. So anyway, I was thinking about that last corner for 20 kilometers. Then with my experience from the track and a bit of youthful abandon, I was the only guy who didn't brake on it. I'd been a bit too far back, maybe 20th position or so under the kilometre kite. Then suddenly everyone's breaking, I'm leaving it to the last second, and I'm screeching around the corner, propping myself against Cipollini. His pedal's scraping the barriers and our shoulders are touching. It's bordering on an illegal manoeuvre, and in fact, I would have been disqualified had the TV cameras got a better view.
Ho toccato il pedale, lui ha toccato il pedale della transenna, insomma, ci siamo un po' spalleggiati.
But the final chase down now, coming from Seiko. There's a sharp bend coming, and in fact, Fontanelli didn't even bother with it. He's allowed them to go through on the inside. This is looking like the perfect lead out now, but watch out for Zarate, he is third wheel here.
Se ci fosse stata una telecamera, mi avrebbero squalificato, no?
But I come out of the corner in fifth place. Saeco are leading out Mario, but I launch my sprint first and I beat him in Prato della Valle, the famous piazza in Padova.
Who's come through on the rails. And Ivan Caranta, what a turn of speed that man has. He came from absolutely nowhere, as he did when he won the first stage.
So I win. Go up on the podium, get my flowers. Then I come back to the bus, park my bike, climb the steps, and then I see Cipollini on our bus.
Come salgo, c'era già su Cipollini. Praticamente io sono salito dal davanti, lui è salito dal dietro. In poche parole, mi sta.
So basically, while I was climbing the steps at the front of the bus, he was climbing the ones at the back. He sees me and he starts coming for me.
Mi sta avendo contro, io sono sceso, sono saltato in macchina, via. Non ho neanche fatto.
So I turn straight back around, jump in a team car and off I go. He didn't even have time to open his mouth. I got the hell out of Dodge. That night we were staying in hotels 500 meters from each other and we met up. He'd calmed down a bit, but it was all still, hey youngster, we almost crashed, you have to be more careful, madonna, cazzo.
Dopo si era calmato, cazzo però giovane, abbiamo rischiato di cadere, stai attento, Mario, che cazzo devo dire.
So by 2001, the two big obsessions for Cipollini on the road were Milan-San Remo and the World Championships. And in 2001, he was beaten by Eric Zabel in Milan-San Remo, must have thought his chance had slipped away. He was establishing himself as one of the great sprinters in Giro history. His tally of stage wins was now up to 34. But in 2002, it all came together for him. He won Milan-San Remo at last on the 23rd of March, the day after his 35th birthday. He added six Giro stages, which put him one behind the all-time record holder Alfredo Binder. And then at the end of the season, he was world champion at last on the motor racing circuit in Belgium at Zolder.
Mario Cipollini con McHugh in a ruota. Cipollini davanti. Cipollini, Cipollini, Cipollini. Ed è nostro! È nostro il mondiale!
But even in the greatest kind of year of his career, there was still time for some controversy. That year he was arrested for motor pacing on the motorway. Again, a suggestion that the rules don't really apply to Super Mario, the Lion King.
What I love about that story, though, Lionel, is that he was tucked in behind a smart car.
Oh, little, that's all right then.
a little baby car. He reckons he was doing, the police thought he was doing 70 kilometres an hour, but he reckons he was actually doing 95 or 100 kilometres an hour. Yeah, listening to some music on his Walkman, paying attention to avoid the potholes in the road when he saw the policeman signalling for him to pull over. But he just carried on. And yeah, again, we'll cover this more in the next episode, won't we? But these little clues that for Mario Cipollini, the rules just didn't apply.
Yeah, and by that time, he really was, we've used the word sheriff. He was that in the Italian peloton. He was that certainly in his team, Saeco. I interviewed Cipollini for the first time in the winter of 2000-2001. I went to their training camp in Marina di Grosseto in the south of Tuscany. And there were a couple of new riders, a couple of neo-pros who had just joined the team. And I was lucky enough to be there for their initiation, which was very much orchestrated by Cipollini. One of the riders was a young American called Justin Spinelli, who had turned pro the previous year
with Domo Farm Fritz or Farm Fritz, and he'd come to Saeco, I think organised by Cannondale. And anyway, that night they played a game which was a kind of, well, it was consisted of the riders having, well, being blindfolded and having to put their finger in an unidentified substance, and they could smell it or they could taste it, and they had to say what it was. So this started, and you know, Cipollini found the whole thing hilarious, and he was sort of filling dishes with ketchup and this and that, and Spinelli was trying to guess, and he wasn't, or he's getting some right, some wrong. And then for about his third or fourth challenge, he, you know, that he still had the blindfold on, and I saw Dario Pieri, big burly Dario Pieri, 90 kilos of him, he was stripping off suddenly, and Dario Pieri got down on all fours with his backside about half a meter from Justin Spinelli's face, and they then produced a tiny dish of what they filled with Nutella, and Spinelli was invited to dip his finger in the Nutella, and by this point, you know, Dario Pieri was completely butt naked, and Spinelli took off the blindfold, looked at the brown substance on the end of his finger, looked at Dario Pieri's naked backside, and ran out of the room shrieking, which, of course...
Lionel and I... Well, Lionel's got his head in his hands. I'm kind of looking through the cracks of my fingers.
I mean, this is sub-Sunday League football club stuff, isn't it? This kind of bants. I don't know. Maybe I'm too old now for this sort of thing, but it's... I suppose, you know, it's men in their 20s, isn't it? Idiots.
He was about 30 years.
Some
he was
of them.
30. Well, how old was he at the time? 30?
He should have known better.
Should have known better. God, dear, oh dear.
I also saw him go absolutely crazy at Soigneur on that training camp for putting the wrong number of bread rolls in his bread basket at breakfast.
Again, it's this kind of excessive behaviour. These anecdotes all add up to create a picture of Cipollini that I already had, really. I mean, it's you know, they all conform to a type, and I wonder if that's part of the legacy of Cipollini, and I guess that's what we'll be talking about in tomorrow's episode. But
that, yeah, it's complicated, isn't it? I mean, I mentioned that in 98, I was one of the whole crowd who gathered around Mario Cipollini just trying to catch a glimpse of him in Dublin, despite the fact he hadn't won the stage. We were all seduced by the charisma, you know, and the showman that we saw in front of us, but you know, the dark side that we weren't aware of so much at the time. The clues were there, perhaps, but the dark side that we weren't aware of did become more evident, and we'll talk about that in the next part. But before we go, quick trivia question for you. You mentioned his world championship in 2002. How many times was Mario Cipollini selected for the Italian team for the world championships?
Good question. Won't there be many, will it?
I would guess once.
Once.
Wow. One for one.
That was it.
I actually didn't know that. That's interesting.
There you go.
But let's hear how Mario Cipollini stacks up in the pantheon of the sprinters from Tom Steels. Does he think that Cipollini is the greatest of all time?
For me, that's still, to be honest, Mark Cavendish, because he had years that he was really unbeatable. But for sure, Cipollini is not so far behind. He's one of the best. He's due to his character, but also due to his victories. He won so many races. That's for sure. He was one of the top sprinters of the history of cycling. That's for sure.
So that sounded fairly emphatic, chaps. Cavendish better than Cipollini, at least according to Tom Steels. But what do you think Mark Cavendish feels about that particular question?
If you ask Chippo, who do you think the best, who was better out of Chippo and I, Chip would say Chippo. But if you ask me, who do I think is better out of Chippo and I'm going to say me.
Well, we'll hear Mark Cavendish elaborate on that tomorrow. Maybe Daniel will elaborate on it too. But in the meantime, thanks very much, chaps. Thank you, Daniel.
Thank you, Rich.
Thank you, Lionel.
Thanks, Rich.